All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck nuts? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. Hope you're doing all right. It's very early. The shooting schedule's got me a little turned upside down, and I got some other things happening in my life that are consuming and overwhelming and taking up a lot of my time. Right off the top here, I do want to thank everyone who's been reading Waiting for the Punch, Words to Live By from the WTF podcast. We're really thrilled with the response. The book is selling well. It's sweet. And we'll be doing our final Waiting for the Punch event of the year in Seattle 1 week from Saturday. Brendan and I will be at Third Place Books in Seward Park, November 11th at 7 p.m. Tickets are available at the store with the purchase of Waiting for the Punch. And if you can't make it and you still want a signed book, you can get one by going to podswag.com/punch. It's the only site that has official signed copies. That's podswag.com/punch. Wow, man. I forgot about this. I forgot about 5 a.m, man. It's 5 a.m. When I was doing morning radio, 5 a.m. was not an unusual place to be, but I, judging by right now, I woke up this morning realizing I had to record this, you know, for this show, because I got to go to set and do shoot all day. And it's just, I got to bring my car in. It's early. It is early. I want to read an email. Hey, Mark, I'm a faithful listener for years and a huge fan of all your work. I'll try to make this short and sweet. I don't want to debate religion, but you've said something twice now in your opening of the podcast that I need to share my opinion on. Most recently, you said it in the Tracy Ullman episode. You said, quote, the evangelicals have made a deal with Satan to pursue their agenda, and Trump is fulfilling that agenda. I'm a Christ follower who has mostly attended non-denominational church as an adult. I do not consider myself evangelical, although I researched what it means to be evangelical, and it's not that far off from my beliefs. I guess I want to make sure you know that just because someone is a believer in the good news, it does not mean that all Christians stand behind Trump or his fellow criminals. I voted for Bernie in the primaries and Hillary in the actual election, so please don't assume that all Christians back Trump. I know you've been raised Jewish, and sometimes you lump all Jewish people into one category and catch flack from fellow Jewish listeners. All I'm doing is reminding you that not all Christians should be lumped into the same category, especially not one so offensive as to state that I want to spend time in the afterlife right now, so I choose Trump to bring forth what is stated in Revelations. That's it. Thanks for being my drive to work companion each day. Oh, and if you get the opportunity, you should interview Issa Rae from the HBO show Insecure. She's brilliant and hilarious. Best regards, Nora. We had Issa scheduled, and I'm trying to make that happen. I'll answer that right away. And you're right. I appreciate your email, but could you get your Christians together to stop the other ones? If there's going to be a war, I wouldn't mind it being between y'all. You dig? Because you know what I'm saying. Shit is real. So 5 a.m. Yeah, morning radio. Reminds me of getting up 2:30 a.m, get to the studio about 3:30, get jacked up on Dunkin' Donuts coffee and M&M's to get on the air at 6. Yeah, we overworked. We did it. We had to do a lot of detailed and significant research every morning to get on the air for Morning Sedition back in the Air America days. But I don't know how I did it. I don't know how I'm doing this. I guess I'm just a worker. I don't know what to tell you. Did I tell you who's on the show? I do have a guy I love a lot. Two guys, actually, it turns out. But John Hammond is on the show, the blues musician. And I was just excited to meet him and to talk to him because I don't know where I got one of his records years ago, but I couldn't believe it. And he's done like 30 records. And he's always out there touring. It's just him and his a couple of guitars. He's beyond great, and he's a very authentic blues musician, and he does something with the music that no one really does. And it was an honor to talk to him. So he'll be here soon. I'll tell you a little story before I start that interview. And coming up first, before John, Michael Rapaport wanted to come by to talk. And which is, when you have Michael Rapaport over, he's got a new book out. It's called This Book Has Balls, Sports Rants from the MVP of Talking Trash. You can get that where all books are available. But those of you who are familiar with Michael Rappaport know that a conversation with him is sort of like an amusement park ride. You kind of get on, you don't know what's going to happen, and you just hold on and engage where you can. I always like having him over. So this is me having a short but intense conversation with Michael Rappaport. What the fuck's going on with you? Are you all right? Didn't you start some shit recently?
No, what shit?
I don't know. Did you, with Trump, did you start some shit?
Oh, start some shit. With Trump, you're finishing shit. You're cleaning up shit. I didn't start any shit. He's like,
Did you know him in New York? Did you ever deal with him?
No, I never dealt with Trump. I seen him around a couple of parties and things like that. But, you know, I mean, the thing about Trump in New York is like, we know what the fuck he's all about. We've seen him out and about chasing skirt and
forever in New York.
He's seen him on the corner before they they fixed up Times. He's a fucking three card Monte player. That's what he is. If you listen to him talk, like his Alabama talk last week, that was classic three card Monte
hustle.
Shuck and jive.
Yeah,
fucking bait and switch shit. That's what he does. He's brilliant. In the same way that, and not in a good way. And
bad kind of brilliant.
You know, and I have to admit, I do see parts of myself in him.
Yeah, that's the difficult thing, right? If you're a little narcissistic, if you're a little bit of a charming asshole, you can sort of like, I get what he's doing.
I get what he's doing, but I'm not the president.
Yeah.
Nor would I want to be
not
the president.
Yet.
No, yeah. Not yet. Anything's
now,
fucking...
Now anything's possible.
If this motherfucker could be president, anybody literally can be president. He's lowered the bar on what's acceptable.
Oh, yeah. In everything.
And so, across the board. So
you got to help me out because, like, you know, I got the book. This book has balls. I see, you know, it clearly is a sporting theme.
Yes.
The theme of sports.
Yes.
Now, I am a non-sports Jew.
Yes. There's many non-sports Jews.
Did we talk about this before? We didn't.
No.
But you're like a full-on sports Jew.
I'm a sports Jew.
Yeah.
I love sports.
Yeah.
I love sports.
What is it, though? One guy said to me once when I told him I didn't like sports, he said, Frank Santarelli, a comedian, goes, well, how do you feel alive?
I understand that. You never played sports growing up?
Sure, I played Little League a little bit. I can hit a ball. I'm a physically fit guy.
You look fit.
Yeah, I'm fit. I can...
Well, how do you stay fit?
Well, I work out and shit, but I mean, I don't... Competitive sports, I played a little tennis, played some baseball, never basketball. I can hit a softball pretty good. I mean, I can do it. I swam when I was a kid.
But can you smack the shit out of... Like, you look like one of those guys who can hit a softball.
I can hit a softball.
Which is not an easy... I'm not a good softball hitter.
Well, you're a basketball player?
I like basketball. I could play ball. I grew up playing ball, but I was never a big... big stick.
Not to hit the ball with the stick kind of guy.
I never could hit it far. Uh-huh. You would think because of like my size.
Yeah.
But there's a technique. I don't have a good stroke, Mark. So you
no,
must
I hear
have
you.
A good stroke.
When I do it, I do it. You know, when there's a lot of misses. There's a lot of, you know...
But you're like a second baseman. I can see you in left field making a diving catch.
Center field. No diving. Fat center field kid. Just backing up. There's a lot of backing up. There's no diving. There's no, holy shit, that thing's coming at me too fast.
Right.
A lot of time.
Right.
There it is. It's hanging there.
I'll get under it.
The story is, I broke my nose in center field because I fell backing up to catch a fly ball.
And you fell on your face?
I tripped backwards and it hit me in the face.
The ball hit you in your nose.
So I had it lined up.
Right.
But that's not a good indicator. You get hit in the face with a ball in center field, you're not a sportsman.
If you get hit in the face with a ball in center field, you're not a fucking sportsman. And I could see why. but that was just like, you know, you didn't fight to overcome it. I could see why.
Because
if I've always had a fear of breaking my nose because I got a very prominent Jew nose.
Yeah.
And I'm proud of this fucking nose. And I don't want anything to happen to it.
Right.
Like, my father's got a nose that makes mine look like Rob Lowe's nose.
Yeah. Well, look, if I take my glasses off, I got...
That's nice, too.
Yeah, I got a thing.
It's
not as full as yours.
No.
You have the full Jew. I have the Roman Jew.
Yes. You have a Roman Jewish
nose. You got a little bulbous going.
Yes. My father's is like, you know, it's like old school dinosaur Jew. He's that kind of dinosaur Jew that won't exist.
Yeah, they're almost gone.
They're almost gone. Like that generation of Jews,
yeah.
They won't be here, yeah. You know, and it's you know,
it's
they'll
sad.
Be extinct.
It's sad.
Like with the giant ears.
Sure.
My father's ears are probably as big as my cock.
Yeah.
Like his ears are huge.
It's a weird comparison, but
I'm just saying, like, they're like, you know, like 11 inches, like my cock. I'm just playing.
Yeah.
So this book has balls, sports rants from the MVP of talking trash.
Who are your teams?
New York teams. But I'm a players guy. Like I love the New York Giants. Yeah. I love the New York Knicks. I'm all fucked up about the Knicks. But I love players. You know, like I love different players, like basketball, football are my things. But you know, like I'll go with, because the Knicks suck, like basketball, like I go wherever. You know, and I can't stand LeBron.
You had to abandon the Knicks?
I had to for my own well-being and my own health.
Because you get too angry?
It's too much. It's a really dysfunctional, abusive relationship, and we deserve better.
Yeah.
We deserve better.
What's going on? Explain it to me.
It's just, the Knicks have not won a championship since 1973. The owner is Trump-like, this guy James Dolan, and he doesn't give a shit about the fans. He's a rich guy whose father was a billionaire, and he was handed Madison Square Garden.
He owns Madison Square Garden?
The Knicks, the Rangers, Radio City Musical. He owns like a lot of New York. He's this little guy. Check this out. He's a billionaire whose father was a billionaire. And he has a blues band. Do I need to explain anything else to you?
What's his name again?
James Dolan.
Ugh.
He's in a fucking blues band.
Yeah, it's no good.
Not a rock and roll band.
A blues band.
A fucking blues band.
And he can play the Garden whenever he wants.
He tours like on a private jet. Like he's a billionaire. The antithesis of blues music. You know your music.
Sure. Yeah.
Fucking billionaire
no.
who owns Madison Square Garden, and he was handed it by his father.
Yeah.
This the type of motherfucker. So there's just been one mishap of handling after another. And he doesn't just own the team, which we couldn't blame him. He's owns the team and he's made basketball decisions. And you can tell he never even had the life experience of getting hit in the face with a softball in center field.
That
like
was a
you
hard
did.
Ball. That was a hard ball.
A hard ball.
Yeah. So
he's never even had that. You could just tell he never.
Sure. Just a gilded cage kid. Silver spoon. Nothing.
And he's in a blues band. He's got the balls to like do public shows.
What's the blues band called?
The billionaire blues band? I don't fucking know. I mean, to have the balls to be in a blues band. And I mean, you got to. And he'll talk about it like, I understand the blues. And I'm like, no, you don't understand fucking anything. You don't even walk around your own city that you own half of. So, you know, the Knicks are fucked up. But the book is essentially that. It's all sports.
What you just did?
Exactly. I mean, that would be another, that's for part two. But it's essentially like, it's just, you know, my frustrations, you know, it's not all like, you know, negative stuff. It's not all like they suck.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I fell in love with Mary Lou Retton in 1984.
Oh, yeah.
I fell in love with
everybody with the gymnast, right?
Yes, but I took it to. I really fell in love. I went to a gymnastics exhibition, and I thought like that was going to be like we were going to fall. I was 14, Mark. So don't judge me.
I'm not going to judge you. So you went to see her on purpose?
I went to the Garden. I actually went to Madison Square Garden
to see her though.
To see Mary Lou Retton, and I went. I was dressed up, and I had cologne on, and I thought like we're gonna.
Yeah, yeah, it's going to happen. You're going to connect.
And she saw me. Looking at her, and God is my fucking witness.
Yeah.
I said, this is came out of me. This has been like a month of preparation, and my father, I was like, you know, I gave up my Christmas presents. I was like, can you just, because he was like, what the fuck do you want to go to see gymnastics for? Like, what the fuck is it? And I was like, I want to just go. I want to go. Like, and he was like, all right, but that's your Christmas present. I was like, all right, I'm on a Saturday by myself. In Madison Square Garden,
dressed up
in a turtleneck and
in your bar mitzvah suit,
and I'm thinking like I'm gonna go there and like Mary Lou Retton and I are gonna fall in love, and I literally while she came out, you know, it was like screaming kids. It was screaming kids and
one
Michael
tall,
Rapaport,
14-year-old,
like a fucking crazy person, but in my head I was like, well, she's gonna see me,
yeah,
she's
it's gonna all come. Natural. This is like destined to happen.
Why shouldn't it?
Yeah,
and I said to her when she got on the mats, I said. I swear to God, me and you, Mary Lou. And she looked over, and God is my witness. She said to her brother, who was like her flunky security guard, that guy looks weird. It's just a true story. And I went back to my seat and then left and then walked home in the fall The fall of
the sad fall of
New York City by myself.
The sad fall, leaves falling down.
And I went home and took down my little shrine I had made for her.
No.
I didn't rip it because I thought maybe we'd reconnect later, but I put it in my closet and that was the end.
You know what's it's even more amazing to me that if you had the opportunity to meet her now and just tell her that, she'd still be scared.
Fuck. And out of all the people I've ever met over the years, I've still never met Mary Lou Retton.
If you said, I got a funny story.
She'd be like, that shit's not funny.
Yeah.
She'd be like,
you're making me nervous.
That guy looks weird to her brother.
So
it's just shit like that. It's fun. And I mean.
Whatever happened to her anyways?
I don't know. She's resting her puffy little feet in West Virginia. She did a lot of jumping on those. She'll always be my sweetheart.
It's funny, though. It's a scary moment when you look back on that stuff and you realize you get something in your head. Like, I was thinking about that the other day, how much you project. Like, how much there's something here. There's got to be something here, right? And you don't know anything.
There's nothing here.
You're making it up.
And men do that way more than
always,
women.
They do it throughout their life. I think I felt something. No. You want that to be there. It's not there.
Yeah. I have a friend of mine. He had a story. I'm not going to name his name.
Yeah.
He's never been on this podcast. I'm not going to name his name.
That narrows it down.
Right. But I remember he was like, me and this girl were vibing and, we were looking at each other in the eyes and, I finally went over to her and I was like, how you doing? And she was like, how you doing? And he was looking at her. He's like an eye contact guy. You're having soul connection.
Yeah.
And he said to her, are you thinking what I'm thinking? And she was like, yeah. And then she said, looks like rain, right? And then he was like, yeah, that's what I meant. But he thought they had this, this long standing, eye contact thing. And she was just like, it's going to fucking rain.
You don't know what the hell people are thinking about.
No, especially with women. And when you're young, you're so, so dumb.
Yeah.
And that was at 14, that was the beginning of my dumbness.
Yeah.
At 14, because 14 to 25, 26, you're so dumb. I was at my prime dumb, at 23.
Yeah, that's where it happens. That's where if you don't, if you live through 23, you're going to make it till your 30s.
You'll make it there.
But it's a dumb time.
Dumb.
Because you just try and figure out who you are, right?
You can't see outside of arm's length, but you think you got it all, and your fucking parents are dumb.
Yeah.
They're dumb.
Yeah.
And you have it all figured out at 19.
Yeah.
And I'm walking around with gonorrhea at 19 and I know everything.
How'd you get that?
Just one night. That was actually 16. I got that plane. I got gonorrhea once.
Yeah.
Once in high school when I first started having sex, and I was having sex with three girls. I had had sex with three girls.
Oh, so you made a mess of a lot of people's lives.
I made a mess. I caught it from somebody, but I was at basketball practice. I might have been 17. I might have even been 18.
All right, so somewhere between 16 and 18.
It was between 17 and 18, and I was at basketball practice. And, this is before they had, compression shorts. When you work out now, they have, compression shorts and underarm. This is where you just had tighty whities.
Yeah.
Or a jockstrap.
Right.
And who the fuck wants to wear a jockstrap when you're 17? So
sure.
I was in my tighty whities at basketball practice at Martin Luther King High School in New York City. And I, was guarding somebody, and did I just piss myself? And I look, and there was a little bit of a green thing. I went to the
green thing.
Gonorrhea. That's what it is, Mark.
It's green.
It's like green. It's like a little drip.
I've never had it.
You're better off. I'm
sure.
Yeah.
I never once thought I kind of wish looking back on.
Yeah, you never had that experience. But only once.
Yeah, you had to go to the doc.
I had to go to the doctor. You had to go to it's not the nurse. It's the health room. You go in there and she's what's the matter? And you have to 17, humiliating that shit is. And then you got to strip in front of a woman who's going to stick a cotton swab in the tip of your loaf.
Yeah.
And then she tells you it's fucking terrible.
Did you ever figure out who gave it to you?
It's just one of these two or three women.
Did you tell them?
Nope. I was 17. I didn't have the balls to tell them. I didn't see them again.
Yeah.
But it was,
Yeah.
It's a shameful thing.
It is. Sure it is.
But luckily it wasn't anything.
Yeah.
Anything long term.
They gave you a shot and that was that.
They gave me a shot, yes, yeah. But the treatment for it isn't as bad as the sticking the cotton swab in there to see what's going on. And as a young 17-year-old, it's embarrassing. I don't even know how we got on. I just admitted I had gonorrhea when I was, and that was 1987, folks. So the ramifications are
you were stupid then.
Yeah,
yeah. So what was I going to say? You're doing a show, right?
I'm on a show now.
With Jennifer Jason Leigh?
Jennifer Jason Leigh.
That I haven't watched.
Atypical.
People like it.
It's a good show on Netflix.
You like working with her?
I love her.
She's great. I had her in here not too long ago.
Oh, did you have her in here?
Yeah, it was great.
She has good stories, right?
Yeah, well, she's just, she's intense. She's a real deal, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah, but she's got good stories. She had a great career.
Yeah, yeah.
Worked with so many people.
Good actress.
Really good actress.
Is it you two working together a lot?
Yeah, me and her working together. We're in a dysfunctional relationship, you know, and she's just good. You know, like I've always been a fan of hers.
Yeah.
And like she was like, you know, somebody who
Did you think that?
No. Well, when she was in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, it was either you were into her or Phoebe Cates.
Yeah.
Like it was like one
sure.
or the other.
Which way'd you go?
I was into Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Yeah.
But I mean, not like Mary Lou Retton.
Right.
And I'll tell her, like, I love you, Jennifer Jason Leigh, but not like Mary Lou Retton. But I will tell you this. When I worked with Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Yeah.
And we worked together for 3 months, every fucking day. The Jackson Brown song, You Got to Be Somebody's Baby.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because that's the song she lost her virginity to in Fast Times.
Right.
So every day it said, I'm like, got to be. And I'm like.
Oh, she must have loved that.
I never told her. I was too ashamed of myself. And she's cool. Like, I asked her all kinds of stories. But I was like, every day. I'd be listening to it. It was like, became my obsessive song. Because
you play it?
I'd play it. I'd sing it. I was like, you got to be some, because that's the song. It was a very sexually charged movie
for a kid.
But she's always been one of my favorites.
Yeah.
And so yeah, Atypical. And then I got this other show that's really fucking good that's coming out on Showtime with Jay Farrell called White Famous, which is nuts.
Yeah, what is that?
Jamie Foxx used to do this bit. He's an executive producer. He used to do this bit about when he first came to Hollywood, like he had made it to a certain level of fame and success, but he wanted to become white famous, like crossover.
Right.
And Jay Farrow is the star of this show, and it's essentially about a young comedian, talented guy who's trying to get big.
Crossover, yeah.
Big, big, big.
Yeah.
But it's very provocative in regards to race.
Yeah.
You know, socially and things that go on in Hollywood, but it's really just about a guy trying to find his way and how much will he compromise or not compromise to reach his dreams.
Yeah.
But it's fucking nuts.
And what do you play?
I play this director who is trying to get this young hot comedian in his show, and the director's like, he's just nuts. He like, you know, believes in method acting, and like, it has to be real, and he keeps sort of tricking him and taking him out of his comfort zone, and it's just very now. And even the title to me, like, I think it's just a great, like, I would love Donald Trump and all his followers to watch White Famous, because it's going to drive them fucking insane.
Yeah. What did we talk about the last time we were here? Oh, it was with Sylvester Stallone, right?
Copland.
Yeah, Copland.
Same type of shit.
But what about De Niro? You work with him?
Yeah, he's my man. Yeah. I love him.
Did we talk about him last time?
I mean, we could talk about him. It never gets old. He's fucking Bob De Niro.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never talked to him about acting. Like,
yeah.
I've talked to him about New York. And just being around him, like, I don't want to be friends with him. Like, it's not like I wouldn't be friends with him, but
right.
I revere him and love him so much. Also, why would he want to be? He's a 7-year-old dude. He's Bob De Niro. What the fuck does he want to talk to me about?
I
literally have been with him and met him. I've worked with him twice. Every time I see him, my heart palpitates. Like, it races like a girl at a Michael Jackson concert. I just have so much respect for him, and he means so much to me, and he's influenced me and inspired me so much.
But what do you talk to him about?
But how you doing, Bob? What's going on? Like, I mean, when I see him, like, he'll kiss me on the cheek.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
And I'm like melting. Yeah. Like fucking Fonzie. You know, like, I'm like literally like, you know, like a girl running away from Fonzie.
Yeah, yeah.
I see him all the time at the Tribeca Film Festival.
Well, he must get familiar with you, because you both grew up in New York.
Yeah.
There's a language.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah. You know, he's familiar, and he knows I love him, and I've done things at the Tribeca Film Festival, and I've worked with him twice. But I just, there's certain people that mean so much to me that I don't want to try to break that.
Right.
I just, he's
one
of them.
Don't want to ruin it in a way.
I don't, it's not that he'll be disappointed. I just adore him so fucking much, and now that he's gotten older, I think he's gotten more comfortable with people like me, and the adoration that he's gotten for 40 years that has already made a very shy person even more shy.
Yeah.
But the fact, I mean, in my opinion, like, you know, what he's done with New York post 9/11 and the outspokenness that he's taken towards Trump.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was one of his best performances when he called him a dog, a mutt.
Yeah.
For him to do that, who doesn't talk about anything, you know that he's crossed paths with Trump over the years. This is a guy who's like, he knows this motherfucker's a dog, a mutt, a con, a lie, a cheat. And I was just like, fuck you, Bob. Tell him what the fuck is up, because we all love you. And we all want to call him a fucking dog, mutt, lie, con, and a fucking cheat.
You memorized a monologue.
Oh, it's one of his best performances, and it was off the cuff.
Yeah.
So
how's everything you got? How's your kids? Good?
My kids are good. They're 15 and 17. They are completely uninterested in everything I have to say or have to do. You know, it's like that white noise.
Really?
And now that they have Uber and stuff and one of them's actually driving, it's like they really don't need shit. Because in L.A., like, you know, you're like a car, you're a car service.
Sure.
A parent. Like, now it's like, you know, they're at the point where, I mean, when I was 15 and 17, my father was like, and I lived in New York.
You were out getting gonorrhea at 17.
You know, I'd come in, Dad, can I get $5? Dad, can I, you know, you shut the door, you come in, you go.
You know what's up with them, but they're good kids.
They're good. They're Rappaports, but they're doing thus far.
You're one of the only guys that can say that, and people are like, oh, okay.
You know, they have tendencies and DNA stuff that they can't escape, but they're doing better than I was at 17.
Yeah, are they in show business?
I hope not.
Oh,
I mean,
so it's not hasn't revealed itself.
It has
yet.
Yeah, it hasn't reared its ugly head yet.
All right, we're going to talk all day. The book, good book. This book has balls, sports rants from the MVP of Talking Trash. I always like talking to you.
I love talking to you.
I imagine you could. Sometimes I feel like, you know, you could be talking and I could be like, I'll be right back.
Just kidding. This is Michael Rappaport hosting the Mark Maron Parry podcast for Mark Maron.
Exactly. You do it. You step right up. Good seeing you, man.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
Michael Rappaport, right? True character, true New York character. His book is called This Book Has Balls, Sports Rants from the MVP of Talking Trash. You can get that where you get books. John Hammond, you know, I thought about this talk that I had with him a lot after I had it. His father was John Hammond Jr., who was a very famous A&R guy at Columbia Records, I believe, who signed Billie Holiday, Bob Dylan. He was involved all the way back, seemingly to the beginning of music, but he was Bruce Springsteen he signed. He was a sort of ever-present, sort of mythic A&R guy. And John Hammond, who I talked to today, is his son. It was not a close relationship from what I understand. And I don't know that I really got to the core of John Hammond here, but what's at the core is some real blues, that's for sure. And maybe some of that is from that father and son relationship. I don't know. Maybe you can hear it underneath this conversation. I'm not one to psychoanalyze. I don't want to talk too much shit, you know, before interviews. But I found it resonant with me thinking about that, what that relationship must have been like. But my experience with John Hammond as a musician, like I had this one record years ago in high school. I don't even know where I got it. I probably got it from a box of records that they didn't want to play at the record store next to where I made sandwiches at the Posh Bagel on Central, across from University of New Mexico, next to Budget Records, which dealt in mostly R&B sounds at the time that I got the records. The owners were kind of R&B people, and they had this box of records that they weren't going to play in the store. In that box of records, some of them changed my life. Certainly Elvis Costello's first record and the John Hammond Mileage album. And I never heard anyone play like that. You know, he plays harmonica, and he plays guitar. Sometimes he plays a resonator guitar, steel resonator guitar. And he does it simultaneously, and he sings. And there's a pace to it. There's an intensity to it. There's something truly unique about the way John Hammond plays and sings. And he's been doing it forever. Back in the day, there were records that he made, you know, with all different types of bands. He made some stuff I didn't realize with, you know, Dwayne Allman. He did records with Levon Helm, Robbie Robertson, way back in the day. He had a great combo for a while on Source Point, and they're just an entire history of music with this guy that goes all the way back to the late '60s. But the thing that I was a strange fan because of this one record, Mileage, for years, and I was visiting my brother. For some reason, I was in Tucson, Arizona. My brother was going to school there. I don't remember what year it was. I don't. I know I wasn't sober necessarily. I don't know. I can't place it in time. But this is my memory of it. I went there. I was with my brother, and we in the paper or somewhere, we saw that John Hammond was playing at the Tucson Blues Society. I don't even know if that exists or what it is. Maybe they didn't have their own venue. But I remember going to a small space. It didn't feel like a performance space. It felt like a bar. And it was me and my friend Laura Madden, who was living in Tucson at the time, and my brother. And we went into this room, and there was no opening act, no nothing. And from what I recall, it was maybe 40 people. And I don't know how they brought him out or why. It must have been a bar. I don't know. But I'd never seen John Hammond, and I'd never seen anything like this. You know, he came out with a National Resonator guitar. And this is my recollection. And he did Robert Johnson's Hellhounds on My Trail. And that's a tricky song because it's, you know, kind of not a full song. It's sort of a meditation. It's sort of a haunted thing, that bit. And he just summoned the spirit of the history of blues, and it all came out of him. The authenticity of his particular type of singing and his presence and the immediacy of what he does is mind-blowing. He didn't want to play when I had him over. I don't know why, but it doesn't matter. You can go listen to him. It would have been great, but it didn't happen. But when he played Hellhounds on My Trail, and I saw that night in Tucson, Arizona, for 40 people, this blues wizard, it just changed everything I understood or knew about the blues and made it very personal and very immediate and he was just a portal to the pain that has always existed in humanity and in that music. And for those reasons, what reasons? All the reasons. Anyways, I went and saw him down here at McCabe's, and he was just as amazing as ever. I met his wife, and they just traveled together, just him and her in the dressing room, and it was great. It was very exciting for me. I wanted to share my excitement about John Hammond with you folks, and maybe you go listen to some John Hammond music. He's going to be in the New York City area tomorrow night, Friday, November 4th, at the Town Crier in Beacon, New York. And I would go see him if you could. This is me and the amazing John Hammond.
Ash Grove was one of the great clubs ever.
Yeah, it was out here?
Yeah, 8162 Melrose.
Oh, I know. I think I heard someone else told me about that place.
Became a comedy club.
Yeah, the Improv.
Yes, exactly.
And back in the day, it was like they had all kinds of music, right?
It was the best.
It was like, but not just blues, everything.
Everything. Bluegrass, jazz, poetry.
That's what became the Improv. That's crazy.
Back in the day, Cheech and Chong were a folk duo.
Yeah.
They did songs, you know, and between songs, they had this patter.
Yeah.
That became so hysterical, the audience didn't want to hear the music anymore.
Is that what happened?
Yeah. I mean, they're both really good guitar players. And
well, I know that Tommy was a songwriter and part of an R&B outfit, Canadian R&B outfit.
I think from Vancouver.
Yeah, he's from Vancouver. Yeah.
And Rich Marin, he lived not far from the Ash Grove.
Uh-huh.
And they used to come hear me play. And when they hit with their with their record, they said, "How'd you like to go on tour with us?" So I opened for them for a bunch of times and all through the Midwest, on little chartered planes.
On that first record, yeah.
Oh, man.
They were huge.
They were so funny. I mean, genuinely funny.
Yeah. They were in here together, you know, not long ago, a few years ago. And they were in and out, you know, as friends, but they're very close no matter what.
Yeah.
But to hear them both on mic in my head, just talking, I was like, oh, shit, that's a Cheech and Chong.
I know, it's wild.
Yeah, they were great.
Yeah.
Well, like where I think the first record I had of yours, like I'm 54, I just turned 54 yesterday. And I somehow I don't remember how
Happy
I got.
Happy birthday.
Well, thank you very much. But like I've always been sort of a blues freak since I was a kid because someone turned me on to it. But the first record I got of yours was Mileage.
Mileage.
Wow. Yeah. And I don't know where it came from in my bag, but I had it in high school. And that, you know, Riding in the Moonlight?
Yeah.
That guitar on that, it just killed me, man. Ooh. That album's great. And that was the door in, right? And then, you know, as I get older, I realize, well, he's done 100 records. There's a lot of records.
A lot of records. Huh.
And then I just the other day, I picked up one, what's it called? It was the one where I look at the back. I had no idea. 67, maybe the fourth record. And I'm looking at the players, and it's Robbie Robertson,
yep.
Levon Helm, Bloomfield on piano.
Right. Charlie Musselwhite's first recording session.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Oh, he's a hell of a hard player. He's still around, right?
Oh, yeah. He's doing better than ever.
Oh, yeah? He's up in the Bay Area?
He's up in, well, north of the Bay Area.
Uh-huh.
And he's doing some touring, I think, with Ben Harper.
Okay. And, all right.
He's doing really well. He was with Cyndi Lauper on her adventure.
And, no kidding. She did a blues adventure?
Yep, she did.
what is that?
No, give me a break.
What does that mean? So which one? That's So Many Roads, right?
So Many Roads, right? 1964.
But like you've been, and then I saw you. This is weird because it was a pretty big moment for me. I was visiting my brother in Tucson.
In Tucson, yeah.
And you were like at the Tucson Blues Society.
Uh-huh.
Something like that. And I was in town. I'm like, that can't be. What, he's just going to be here? And there must have been like 40 people there.
Yeah.
And but the thing was amazing, though. You played Hellhounds, and you just summoned the thing. I mean, I've never heard, like, because when you listen to the Robert Johnson records, you can't picture that stuff being activated in the sense of being live. But you did it.
I do so many Robert Johnson songs. Yeah.
Was that a relationship that, in terms of your relationship with that music, did that come later, or was that there at the beginning?
It was there in the beginning. I first heard Robert Johnson on a folkways album called The Country Blues.
Yeah.
That Sam Charters produced.
Yeah.
It was out of his collection, I'm sure. And there was just one cut, and who is this guy, you know?
Yeah.
So I made it a...
What cut was it?
Preaching Blues.
Oh, yeah.
And then it became a quest to find out if he had recorded other things. Nobody seemed to know anything about
him. Were you playing already?
No, I was just a fan.
Like, how old were you when you first heard that stuff?
16.
Uh-huh.
And so I found two other cuts of his on a Origin of Jazz Library. I think it was Swedish label or something.
Isn't that wild?
And found two more.
So they hadn't put it all out. They hadn't put that collection out yet.
No. See, my dad was responsible for that. See, I didn't really grow up with my dad.
John Hammond Sr.
Yeah, I knew him on occasion, you know, from, you know, certain weekends,
yeah.
2 weeks in the summer, that kind of deal. And
but he signed Billie Holiday, right? Dylan, Springsteen, all of them. But you weren't hanging out there.
No, I didn't hang out with him. So one day I was up at his house.
Yeah.
And I said, Dad, have you ever heard of a guy named Robert Johnson? He said, funny you should ask. And then he was trying to get him to play at his Spirituals to Swing concert
uh-huh.
in 1938.
Yeah.
And he had tracked him down and found out he had died. Ooh.
Yeah.
So he said, not only that, and he opens his cabinet.
Yeah.
And he had four Robert Johnson records.
The 78?
On Vocalion. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
It was like a treasure trove.
Oh, my God.
I couldn't believe it. I felt the hair stand on my neck kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
And he introduced me to this guy at Columbia who was in charge of the archives named Frank Driggs.
Your dad did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Frank made me a tape, a reel-to-reel tape of like 12 Robert Johnson songs.
Oh, my God.
It was like I had died and gone to heaven kind of, and it was just unbelievable. And
So you were 16 about?
No, I was 17 by then.
Yeah.
The album was released in 1960. Yeah.
Those 30 songs or however many?
No, there weren't that many. There was like 12, I think.
And that was it.
And that was it. Well, there were others. There were outtakes and stuff. But the king of the Delta Blues was that album.
Yeah.
And not long after that, I started playing guitar.
Your old man put that out.
He did. He produced it. And Frank Driggs was the guy who engineered it and, you know, made it sound really good.
So that was your moment.
That was a moment, yeah. But I mean, I was a blues fanatic at that point. You know, I was into, Blind Boy Fuller, Blind Willie McTell, all the country blues guys.
Who was the guy that lived in New York that Top Bromberg had to play? Which one was that?
Gary Davis.
Reverend Gary Davis. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he was in the Bronx.
Yeah.
I went to his house once.
You did too?
Oh, yeah. Jorma Kaukonen was like a real fan of his too. I went to school in Antioch College in Ohio. And Jorma Kaukonen was a student there, older than me by a year. And he and this guy named Ian Buchanan were the guitar players. And Ian Buchanan was like a really great guitar player and a good singer, too.
Yeah.
He was very shy.
Yeah.
So he never really got a career going for himself, but he was really phenomenal. And Jorma was hanging out with him all the time.
Uh-huh.
He played a lot of Blind Boy Fuller stuff and a lot of that Piedmont style. I used to watch them play and say, oh, holy shit.
You know, I got to get to work. And you were playing at that point?
I had just bought a guitar, and I was too shy to ask anybody to show me anything, but I watched, and I picked up stuff. And 1961 is when I started to really get intensely into it.
So you grew up in New York City?
I grew up in New York City. I went to art school in Skowhegan, Maine.
Uh-huh. And your folks weren't together?
No. I grew up with my mother and my brother Jason.
Yeah.
And in the village.
Oh, yeah.
And so I watched the whole village scene.
What did you go to art school for?
I was a painter and a sculptor. That's what I did. That's what I was good at. Everything else
when you were a kid? Weird.
Yeah. And so I got into this like very prestigious art school.
Yeah.
One of my roommates was a guy named David Goetz.
Yeah.
And David, was a really good painter.
Yeah.
One of the teachers there was Alex Katz.
Oh, sure, yeah. I know his work, yeah.
Talk like this. He's from Brooklyn, you know. He says, I'm a paintner. Not a painter, a paintner. He was such a character and such a phenomenal painter and a good teacher. David Goetz was one of my roommates, and I had a collection of 45s, and everybody wanted my records, so there'd be parties. And I was 17. I was the youngest student ever there. And all these guys were like scholarship guys from really well-known art schools and stuff. And
you were this kid.
And so, I was the kid.
Yeah.
And David, after Skowhegan, he went to the San Francisco School of Fine Arts. And he loved to play drums and stuff, so he was always fooling around and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, he put together Big Brother and the Holding Company.
No kidding.
He was the drummer.
Yeah.
He was the one who got Janis Joplin and stuff. And it's a small world,
It was then.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's small anymore, but it's certainly like that's always fascinates me about the scene.
Yeah.
Because you're only the folk scene was rock and roll officially starts in 57, and the folk scene was even more intimate. And so there, you were there at the beginning. At that stuff.
Saw it all happen.
So why'd you give up painting?
Because once I had that guitar and started to sing those songs that I loved, that's all I wanted to do. It's like I found my calling.
So you start playing guitar at what age?
61. I was 18.
That's late.
Yeah, I guess. But I knew all the songs. I knew all the words.
Because you've been listening to the blues for so long.
Right.
Wandering around the village.
Yes, and
yeah. Were you going to see those guys before you started playing?
I saw Josh White and Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, Lead Belly once. But when I was seven,
Yeah.
My father took me to hear Big Bill Brunzi.
Oh, yeah.
This is 1949.
Wow.
And Big Bill was unbelievable. And my father knew him.
Yeah.
And so he introduced me to him, and I was awed. I think that was the point at which I knew that blues was in me somehow, because, I mean, I really connected to that music. And
it really is in you.
I guess after 55 years on the road, I guess.
No, but like even at the beginning, I mean, your feel for it is insane. I mean, no one plays like you, and no one in the depth of it, because that's the experience I had listening to Hellhounds when you sat there with that national guitar in a small room with 40, 50 people in it. And you it was like you you brought that thing to life.
Yeah.
And it's a dark bit of business.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I was into it completely. I think that club was called Terry and Zeke's Friendly Bar.
In Tucson?
In Tucson. And there was a great DJ called Kid Squid.
Uh-huh.
And Kid Squid had this great collection of records. I mean, all kind of stuff.
Yeah.
From blues to, you know, funky R&B to a lot of rockabilly stuff.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, he was the best DJ I ever heard, and he made me up some cassettes for the road, you know.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, they were phenomenal.
Oh, that's sweet.
In 1961, you know, I made a trek to Chicago, hoping to see Muddy Waters or Howlin'
Wolf. Yeah,
somebody.
Yeah.
And I met Michael Bloomfield and Charlie Musselwhite, and they took me all around to all these clubs, and
yeah.
I got to see Wolf and Muddy, and
no kidding.
And not only was Michael a great guitar player,
yeah,
Muddy and Wolf would call him up to sit in on the bandstand. Like,
no shit.
God, he was 17 and I was 18, and he was just amazing.
And you just met him, you just found him.
At the University of Chicago, there was a folk festival going on.
And you went to see it?
I didn't know Chicago at all. And then I met Michael and them, and they showed me around.
And Charlie was a kid too?
Charlie was a kid too. If you turned sideways, you couldn't see him.
Oh, really?
String bean.
Lanky.
Oh, yeah.
So that was before Bloomfield was playing with anybody.
That's before he was playing with anybody.
With Paul Butterfield, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Paul and Michael had a kind of love-hate relationship.
Wasn't he in the band or no?
Oh, he was eventually. But the way it turned out was that, you know, Paul wanted to be the guy.
Yeah.
He had Elvin Bishop playing guitar with him.
Right.
And he wouldn't let Elvin take a solo.
But he's a harmonica player.
Paul.
Yeah.
Yeah, he took all the solos.
So no guitar solos, just all,
no,
I get it.
Yeah, right,
yeah,
just,
I get it.
Just in the pocket. Man.
No kidding.
So Elektra Records said, the only way we'll record you, Paul, is if you have a lead guitar player. And it's got to be Michael Bloomfield.
Ooh.
And I don't think Paul was very happy about that.
Mm.
But they made some great records. And,
they did. And then Bloomfield went on to play with Dylan in those seminal sort of first electric
things. I introduced him to Dylan.
You did?
I introduced the band to Dylan. Dylan and I were really good friends. You know, when Bob first moved to New York,
uh-huh,
there were three guys, Kerner, Ray, and Glover. And they were from Minneapolis.
Yeah.
And they were hanging out in New York playing gigs at coffee houses. And they were really good.
Yeah.
Dave Ray played a 12-string guitar.
Uh-huh.
John Kerner played 6-string. And Tony Glover played harmonica.
Uh-huh.
And they were just wonderful.
Yeah.
And when Dylan came to New York, they introduced me to Bob. And
Because they were from Minneapolis.
Yeah,
they knew him from back then.
And we got along really well right off the bat, and Bob was, you know, like a Woody Guthrie guy.
Yeah.
Know? He had talking blues and stuff that were, and he was fantastic. I mean, what a great solo, man. That guy could really grab you, you know?
Yeah. Was he hanging out with Ramblin' Jack then?
Oh, yeah. He knew Jack. The whole folk scene was so intense. Dave Van Ronk and all these great players in New York. I mean,
and you were in it too.
Oh yeah, I was hanging. I was there.
Now, what year was this?
1961 and two.
So you're playing out now.
Yeah, I'm playing in little clubs, the pasture hat, coffee houses,
but not like Cafe Wa or
the Cafe. Well, the Cafe Wa didn't come until a little later.
Okay,
but there were others, the Fat Black Pussycat, and all these joints, and me and Dylan Richie Havens.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
John Sebastian.
Mm-hmm.
A guy who called himself Juan Moreno. I think his name was Peter Cohen.
Yeah.
But he played flamenco style. And, uh-huh. Oh, it was a scene. It was really a great scene. It was intense.
And this is before it blew up. This is like as it
was. This is 61, early 62.
And there was that one record store or that had.
The Folklore Center?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It was like the headquarters.
Izzy Young ran the whole thing. Dave Van Ronk was like the mayor of,
I mean,
he knew everybody. Anybody coming through that played a little blues or whatever would hang out with Dave Van Ronk.
And then those old blues guys got integrated into this scene, correct?
Later.
So you meet Dylan and you meet the guys from the band.
No.
Okay.
I was playing gigs starting 62. My career, I came to Los Angeles in March of 62.
Really?
And I started my whole career here.
No kidding.
I went as far away from home as I could get and
made
myself up and was playing at the Ash Grove and the Troubadour.
You moved here?
I moved here, yeah. I was ready to be somebody else, you know. I wanted to be John Hammond, the blues singer.
Not John Hammond, the kid of the guy.
Right, I mean, lots of luck with that.
From the neighborhood, or the
but
painter.
Anyway, I was out here for about 8 months. I got my first gig through Hoyt Axton.
Oh, yeah.
Hoyt was just the greatest guy. Oh, man, what a wonderful human being. And he got me my first paying gig in Southgate, the Satire Club. Frank and Joyce Thompson owned this place, and it was wonderful.
Uh-huh.
From there, I played at the Insomniac.
Where was
Bob
that?
Bob Hare. That was in Hermosa Beach.
Oh, wow.
Oh, and these were paying gigs.
And you're with the band or just on the guitar?
No, I was just playing solo. That was how, to me, that was the art. If you could pull it off as a solo, that was like being Robert Johnson or Willie McTell or Blind Boy Fuller. That was the thing for me. So anyway, I worked all these gigs out here.
Who are you working with? Who's on the shows with you?
Oh, God. I was so many. I played at the Ash Grove as an audition for opening for the Staple Singers.
Oh.
And that was, they were awesome. They were just pops on guitar, Roebuck Staples, Mavis, Purvis, and Cleotha.
I saw you open for them, I think, at the Bottom Line.
Yeah.
Like maybe a decade ago or so. Is that possible?
That's very possible.
And I remember
I worked a lot of shows with them.
I remember watching you and I saw a string pop in the second song and I was like, oh, God damn it. Now he's got to deal with that.
I can change it in 20 seconds. No problem. Anyway.
So Staples and.
And Pop Staples, you know, I played my little set and he came up to me and said, son, I don't know how in the world you learned to play like that. But whatever you do, don't stop. And it just filled me with a whole room. You know, I mean, I just knew this was, you know, it was going to happen.
Yeah.
Anyway,
that's amazing.
I got to meet all these players out here. I started to work often at the Ash Grove.
Yeah.
The Ash Grove was the greatest club. I worked shows there with Lightning Hopkins, with Doc Watson.
Oh, yeah, Taj said he used to be a door guy there.
Yeah, he was.
That's who it was.
Taj moved here from Boston.
Yeah.
And Taj, like, put together the Rising Suns. They were so good.
Oh, yeah. That first record?
Oh.
Yeah.
It
sounds like a chess record.
I mean, Ry Cooder.
Oh, yeah.
And Jesse Ed Davis. Oh, my God. These guys could really play. And Taj was a great harmonica player and a great guitar player. He was the real deal.
And you said you opened for Wolf?
Yeah, I opened for Wolf at the Ash Grove for a week. Oh. It was incredible.
With his whole band, with Hubert and the guys?
Yeah, Hubert, the whole package.
Wow.
And Wolf told me stories and stuff. I mean, he was really nice to me.
I mean,
he really thought I could play. And
you can play. But you were like 22?
I was less. I was maybe 20, 21.
And you were still, it was just you and the guitar?
Yes, that's all I aspired. And then I came back to New York and I auditioned at Gertie's Folk City, which was the club in New York, and I got the gig, and me and Phil Oakes played for a week, and were held over for a week.
Wow.
And we both got signed up to Vanguard Records.
Vanguard,
I've been playing for less than a year professionally, and I had my first recording deal. And I knew Bob really well at the time.
Bob Dylan?
Bob, yeah. Bob was the guy.
You still talk to him?
No.
Not really?
No, Bob is,
he's off in Bob land.
Yes. But he was just, I think he's incredible.
Sure, yeah.
And anyway, I was playing gigs. I got a manager and an agent in 63, Manny Greenhill, Folklore Productions.
Oh, yeah.
And I got all these gigs in Canada, Toronto, Ottawa, Montreal.
Really? Did they like you better up there or something?
No, there was a folk scene that was happening. There was a circuit.
So this is still before the blues folded in, or around the same time, where the old blues, the guy.
63, I was playing gigs in Toronto, and a guy came backstage after one of my shows and said, "Hey, listen, there's a band playing in town at the Concord Tavern. You got to come check them out."
Yeah.
So it was Levon and the Hawks.
Yeah.
And they were incredible.
Yeah.
And Robbie was like so intense, such a great guitar player. And Levon could sing his ass off. And they had a piano player named Richard Manuel.
Uh-huh.
And he was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And he could sing too. Yeah, they were great. So anyway, they would call me up and sit in. And we became really good friends.
You'd go sit in with them.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they would come down. See, they were the backup band for Ronnie Hawkins.
Ronnie Hawkins,
They left Ronnie and went out on their own, but played a lot of the same gigs that Ronnie played when he came to the U.S. So they'd come down to Jersey Shore. Tony Mart was one of the clubs they played, and Joey D's Starlighter Lounge. And I'd come and sit in with them and stuff, And one day they were trying to get a recording deal in New York, and it wasn't happening. And I was already signed to Vanguard. So I said, "Well, how would you guys like to play with me on a record?"
Yeah.
I said, "Sure, what the heck?" And
So
I invited Bob to the session, and Michael Bloomfield and Charlie were in town that week. And we had one session, that's 3 hours, and we made that whole album in
that
3 hours.
In So Many Roads?
So Many Roads.
In 3 hours.
Yeah, Vanguard thought that they were kind of scruffy.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, it came out real good. I introduced everybody to Dylan.
Yeah.
The next thing I know, Robbie and Levon are playing with Dylan, And
wow. It's like,
so I'd introduced them all to Dylan, who used everybody. He used Michael Bloomfield. Bob and I were really good friends, and he really respected where I came from.
Well, it was probably, too, because that wasn't really his world. And,
he was a blues fan, though.
Right.
Oh, of course. Always.
Right, but he really built the folk thing.
That's right.
Yeah.
So when he broke out, it was monumental.
And it was a smart next step, the blues,
it
electric
was his
blues.
Thing. Yeah. It was his thing. He really... he had the vision, and he did.
I talked to Robbie.
You did? Well,
I have. When he talks about that tour, he was like, "Oh my God, they're just getting booed off stage everywhere."
And it must have been unbelievable. I can't imagine how.
And then he wanted to do more.
Yeah,
And if he hadn't sadly had that motorcycle accident, the band might not ever happen.
I know. Tell me about it, man. It's wild.
Wow. It's too much. So what? So the first three records, you just dumped all at once? They all came out in 64, your first three?
No. My first album I recorded in December of 62.
Okay.
It was released
that
summer.
Yeah.
And then I went into the studio again that fall. I made Big City Blues.
Yeah.
And then the next year I made an album called Country Blues, which
is
also acoustic solo.
Yeah.
And then that fall, it was, I think, November or so of 64. We did this So Many Roads album.
Yeah.
And then Robbie and I went up to the Brill Building, Tin Pan Alley, into Lieber and Stoller's office.
You did, yeah.
And we talked them into giving us a session to do a demo single.
Uh-huh.
and they had a studio. The Rolling Stones were in town, and they'd come to hear me play the year before.
The Stones.
Yeah. So Brian Jones and Bill Wyman came to the recording date. I got Bill to play bass on it.
Yeah.
And Rick Danko.
Ah.
And they had a studio drummer named Charles Otis from New Orleans who had come up on Lieber and Stoller's request. And so we were going to make two sides, right?
Yeah.
And we had a 3-hour session and we cut like 18 songs.
No kidding.
Yeah.
And that's
it became I Can Tell.
I Can Tell, right.
Yeah.
Danko's on that record?
Yeah. And Bill Wyman, I told Brian Jones, I'm sorry, I'm playing harmonica.
Okay.
So, and Robbie played as good as I ever heard anybody play guitar on that, man. He just killed me.
Oh, man.
I mean, Robbie, when he wanted to play blues, he played blues.
He can, right?
It always shocked me when he started playing, you know, more folk style stuff. But I guess that's, you know... Dylan's influence.
Sure. Well, he cut his teeth on, you know, real roadhouse shit. I mean, they had to deliver.
I spent a lot of time with those guys in Toronto, you know. I mean, I've been to Robbie's home. I met his mother.
Yeah.
You know, it was a very tight-knit scene. And,
that's sweet.
And Toronto had so many great players, you know. Oh, man, Toronto was a real scene.
Like, man,
David Clayton Thomas had a band called Powerhouse.
Yeah.
And they were phenomenal.
Mm. It was just like a lot of people doing it up there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Man.
Were you a fan of like the British guys?
Not really, not in the beginning. But when the Stones came to hear me play and I got to know Brian Jones, and Brian was a blues fanatic just like me.
Uh-huh.
You know, he was into it. And if he had lived, I suppose they'd still be, you know, doing a whole lot more blues.
Was that like 65, 66?
64
and
5.
Oh,
that's when I knew them, yeah. And anyway...
Because they were a real blues band. That's what they wanted.
Yeah. I was on shows with Fleetwood Mac.
Peter Green.
Oh, man.
Oh,
I was on shows with them, and I heard them playing. I said, this is a blues band.
No kidding.
And the next thing I know, they're doing rock and roll. And
well, he kind of spun out somehow.
Yeah, whatever. I don't know. Listen,
I
don't want to get into, you know, I didn't know everybody that well, so I didn't
know. But he was a hell of a player, though, huh?
Oh, yeah, man. And Jeremy Spencer.
Yeah, yeah.
Ooh, man, these guys were into it big time. They were great.
Blues fanatics. Yeah. That was the thing. That's the thing, really, wasn't it?
Eric Clapton. I did my first tour in England in 65.
Yeah.
I went over there, you know, not knowing much about the scene, and I met everybody. I went on tour with John Mayall.
Oh, yeah.
And I met Eric Clapton, who was playing guitar with him. And Eric was just... you know, phenomenal. I mean, his idol was Freddie King.
Freddie King, yeah.
And he had that down. And,
yeah.
But he is also, like, brilliant. You know, I mean, he had that upper vision, I guess.
Uh-huh.
He really knew what he was all about.
And that was when he was playing with the Blues Breakers?
Yeah, the Blues Breakers. Yeah. And I met Stevie Winwood. And, I mean, these guys were really great players. I met Georgie Fame. There was a guy named Graham Bond, the Atomic Bond.
Yeah.
He played the organ and the saxophone at the same time.
Sure, yeah.
He was nuts, man. This guy was out there.
Yeah.
I was over in England, and Bob came and played his first show
in
England and invited me to the Royal Albert Hall to hear him play, and he killed it.
With the band?
Oh, no.
Just by himself?
By himself.
Oh, before, yeah.
Joan Baez was there.
Ooh,
oh, my. I was hanging out in the back, and everything was being filmed by the Pennybakers and whatever it was.
Oh, that's that tour, the Don't Look Back tour, from the movie.
Right. And then after the show, there was this big party, and there were the Beatles.
Come on.
Yeah, I know. John Lennon walks up to me, and he says, Dr. Kildare. And I said, no. He says, I know. He said, how would you like to drive around Hyde Park in my Rolls Royce? I said, okay. And we drove around, and and it was really cool.
Yeah, really cool.
Uh-huh. And, I mean, John Lennon was something else, man.
Sweet guy.
And, oh, God.
Funny, right?
So great. And funny and brilliant, you know.
Yeah,
I felt intimidated, honestly.
Yeah. But you had a good time.
Oh, man. Yeah. So anyway, I went back to the U.S. and all full of myself, you know, and I was 65, and 66 I was hanging out in the Village playing at the Gaslight.
Yeah.
And I mean, it seems like so much happens yeah. in a short time when you're happening, you know.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I was playing at the Gaslight. Yeah. A friend of mine, Ben Applebaum,
yeah.
came down and said, "Man, there's a guy playing across the street at the Cafe Wa. He's playing stuff off your record." I said, "Ooh." So I went over between sets, and yeah. it was Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
He called himself Jimmy James at the uh-huh. time.
And, yeah.
And he was hanging out, and when he got done playing, I was introduced to him, and he said, "Man, I'm starving. Can you get me a gig?"
Yeah.
So I'd played a show at a place called the Cafe Ogogo.
Uh-huh.
Howard Solomon was the owner. And so I went over to Howard the next day, and I said, "You know, if I put a band together..."
Yeah.
He said, "I got an opening next week." So I put this little band together with Jimmy James playing lead guitar.
Come on.
I think every musician that was in New York came to the show. We were there for a week.
Because of just they knew about you guys?
Yeah. I mean, man, Jimmy was unbelievable. He played with his teeth. He was just awesome.
Was this like before the Isley Brothers, or like hadn't he played with them a little bit? Or
after the Isley.
Okay.
He'd been on the road with Curtis Knight.
Right.
And he was fired
uh-huh.
from the band
for
in
being
New
too
York.
Good?
In New York. Yeah, uh-huh. probably upstaging yeah. him. And so he was just hanging out in New York. He was kind of stranded. And
so you put a band together.
I put the band
Who's
together.
Who's playing bass?
Oh, God. There was so many guys sat in with
oh,
us.
Oh, really? Just an ongoing sort of
yes,
like parade.
It was great, though.
Were you playing electric?
Yeah, I was playing electric. And at the end of the week, Chaz Chandler from the Animals
yeah.
came up to Jimmy and said, "You know, I'd love to record you. Here's money for a plane ticket to England. I'll record you and I'll put you on the uh-huh. map." And he went.
And that was it, man.
Oh man!
But when you guys were playing together at that time, could you just tell that he was beyond
anybody that heard him play would just say, "Who is that?
Yeah, what is going on?"
No, he was unbelievable. He was truly amazing, and anybody that heard him would flip out.
And did you ever see or work with Jimmy Reed?
Jimmy Reed, yeah.
Yeah, because he lived a while, right?
Oh, he was incredible.
Yeah.
He was the guy, everybody loved him. Jazz guys loved him, bluegrass guys, country guys, everybody loved Jimmy Reed.
Yeah.
So I opened for him in Oakland. A guy named Chris Schrakowitz put together this concert. And I opened for Jimmy Reed. It was just awesome.
You were a fan, right?
Oh, I was just like idolized him. Yeah. Anyways, I got back to New York eventually, and I told my friends, you know, I was on the show with Jimmy Reed.
Yeah, yeah.
And they said, "Right,
uh-huh.
Yeah, but yeah." After a while, I got I got tired of being told I was wrong.
Yeah,
and so I like to tell this story about. 12 years ago, Martin Scorsese put on the Year of the Blues Spectacular, Radio City Music Hall, 50 artists, count them. And there were 2 days of rehearsals.
Yeah.
My wife, Marl, and I are backstage, and John Fogerty walks up to me. He says, "Man, I saw you open for Jimmy Reed." Whoa. It's like, yeah. No, it was really cool.
Because he's from up there.
Yeah, man.
He's probably a kid who went to go see it.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I mean, it was, you know, I mean, I've had a lot of moments like that where, you know, it all sort of comes together.
Right, right. So when did you start doing the, you know, because like I noticed on, like, you go back and forth, but like Source Point, that's 1970 already, right? And you did it on the other records too, but you put together a full electric band.
In 1967, after I'd had the experience playing with Jimmy, I approached Charles Otis, who had recorded on the I Can Tell record.
Uh-huh.
And I said, would you be interested in going on the road with me if I put a band together?
He's a drummer?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He started his career in 1950
right.
with Professor Longhair.
Oh, down in New Orleans.
Oh, he's a New Orleans guy.
Yeah, so he's got that swing.
So Charles thought about it for a minute, and then he said, you know, I don't think I'd do it for anybody else, but for you, I'll do it. So we put together this power trio, right?
Yeah.
And John Hammond and the Screaming Nighthawks.
Is that what it was?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And we went came out to the West Coast in 67,
mm-hmm.
played at the Avalon Ballroom with mm-hmm. The Grateful Dead and all these other bands.
Bill
and,
Graham presents?
No, this was Chet Helms.
Okay.
And
before Bill Graham?
Maybe Bill was out here, but this was the offer that I had.
Yeah.
So I eventually played a lot of gigs for Bill.
Yeah.
What a guy.
Yeah.
He was the first guy that ever gave me a bonus.
Oh, really?
$250. Wow. I was in heaven.
Played the Fillmore a lot?
Yeah, I played the Fillmore East and West.
Yeah.
But
that was in later in the 60s?
Later in the 60s, yeah.
All right, so wait, tell me about this trio. So you guys get out there.
Oh, so Charles Otis and Herman Pittman played the bass on some of the dates.
Yeah.
Other times we used Lee Collins. Other times, Sherman Holmes.
Uh-huh.
Charles knew everybody. I mean, everywhere we went, if we came to L.A., we had a horn section.
Uh-huh.
If we went to, you know, I mean, he knew everybody everywhere. It was outrageous.
And that's nice to go that loose with that music.
Oh,
so you
man.
Can, sure, you can, anyway, it's like jump in kind of music, right?
Yeah, it wasn't, but, you know, it was like my call.
Yeah.
And Charles had enough respect for me to, you know, say, okay,
yeah,
listen to what he says. And,
yeah.
And it was, you know, I mean, Charles was a real mentor to me in so many ways. He was so professional. And he had toured with Lloyd Price and Little Richard. He had toured with all these great New Orleans bands, you know, and had done the whole Chitlin' circuit, you know. And I mean, he was an amazing.
And that's what led to Source Point?
That's what led to Source Point. And it was supposed to be produced by Lieber and Stoller.
Yeah.
One afternoon at Columbia, and they said, John, we're out of here. I can't work with these people.
With who?
With Columbia Records.
Okay.
So all of a sudden, it was in my lap. And I had Charles on drums and Billy Nichols on the bass.
Uh-huh.
And that was it. That was the
You produced it.
Yeah. I had to. I mean, we had already booked
the dates.
It's
probably the best thing, man.
It was great, man. We had so much fun. It was so much fun.
I can't imagine that record if Lieber and Stoller produced it.
Oh, it would have been great. They had a
but it's pretty
keyboard
pretty...
player named SQ Reader who was going to be on the show.
Uh-huh.
SQ Reader.
Yeah.
And he was a protege of Little Richard.
Uh-huh.
And he was out there. But
he didn't play?
No, he didn't play because Mike and Jerry said no. Anyway.
Good record, though.
Oh, yeah. Columbia
solid.
Did nothing with it, nothing for it. I think they didn't know what to do.
Is that wasn't that your dad's label?
Yeah, but
he wasn't around.
It was awkward, you know.
Yeah,
very awkward. I got the thing because I got signed to Columbia because Arthur Penn, had asked me to do the music for Little Big Man.
Great job on that, by the way.
And that's what. In order to do it, I had to sign with Columbia.
Wow.
So I signed with Columbia and flew out here to do the.
Yeah.
I mean, I played live to the track. I mean, to the.
That was just you and a
film.
Guitar, though. Was it?
Yeah.
Was that a National you used? On that?
I used a National on some tunes and the other on my Gibson.
Yeah. I remember seeing that's haunting, man. That's like way before Bry Cooter did.
What a movie.
Oh, yeah, man.
Man, I was so impressed.
It's a great
movie. I said
great.
To Arthur Penn, I said, you know, the music I'm playing didn't exist then. He said, doesn't matter, it'll work.
Yeah.
Arthur Penn was incredible.
It didn't exist then. He's like, it'll work.
Anyway, I mean, because he had done
Bonnie and
Clyde with Flat and Scruggs, and that worked.
yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I remember that the opening scene with the with Hoffman and the old man. Turn that thing on.
Yeah, right.
Turn that thing on.
Right, man.
Yeah. Oh, so that's how you got into Columbia.
Yeah, that's how
through
I got
the side
into,
kind of.
Yeah. So we made Source Point,
and they just sat on it. And you had one of those. You have one of those gold top deluxe.
Yes, I did.
It sounds so fucking good on that record, man.
I had so much fun making that record. anyway, the band was together. We were touring.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we weren't getting any promotion. I was not making bucks, whatever.
Right.
We'd go out on the road for a month and come back. I mean, I'd be broke.
Yeah.
Because I wanted everybody to get paid.
With that band.
Yeah.
The Source Point band.
So I did some tours solo. I went back to playing solo, and I was on tour with Delaney and Bonnie.
Oh, yeah.
And Delaney kept saying, man, I love to produce a record on you.
Yeah.
So I went up to Columbia, and Clive Davis had just become the guy at Columbia, and I said to him, Delaney and Bonnie want to produce an album on me, and Clive looked at me and said, who? And they had the number one and number two singles on the Billboard charts.
Yeah.
I said, Delaney and Bonnie, and I showed him that. He says, oh.
Yeah.
So anyway, I came back out here and we made I'm Satisfied.
Yeah.
That was number two for Columbia. And Delaney said to me, man, if this ain't a hit record, I'm going to kiss your ass on Broadway. That's what he said to me. And Clive Davis was so impressed with Delaney and Bonnie that he signed them, bought everything they ever did for Atlantic. Gave him a bonus check for $250,000. I know this because Delaney showed me the check.
Yeah.
And they did nothing for me. And they went in this studio with Delaney and Bonnie, and a month later they got divorced, and then nothing ever happened.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
They keep the money?
What's that? Oh, I'm sure they kept the money. But anyway, that was the end of that. And then the third record I made for Columbia was with Michael Bloomfield and Dr. John.
Oh, yeah, I have that record.
Triumvirate.
How do you feel about that record?
I thought it was really good. There were some cuts on it I thought could have been, you know, hit records or whatever.
Yeah.
But never got promoted because every record label, Columbia, Atlantic, everybody got investigated by the FBI for
payola.
Oh, yeah.
Bad time.
So there was no promotion, no nothing. We had just taped.
Oh, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it was kind of a bummer for me. And so I went from Columbia, I went to Capricorn.
Yeah.
Because I had gotten to know Dwayne Allman really well. He had recorded an album, my last one for Atlantic.
Which one?
It was called Southern Fried.
Oh, and he's on that?
Yeah, man, is he ever.
I got to get that record.
And we got...
We got
to be really good friends, and Dwayne was phenomenal.
He's another guy that was sort of had the gift, right? Kind of touched.
Awesome. I've worked with some great guitar players, no kidding.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I Dwayne had died. I had gone to... Capricorn because he said, oh, you know, we got a really good deal down there. So I went down to Macon and I made an album called Can't Beat the Kid.
Yeah.
On Capricorn.
And then he died?
No, Dwayne had died before.
Already? Oh, yeah.
I mean, but I had done gigs with the Allman Brothers.
Sure.
And I had signed up with the Paragon Agency in Macon.
Yeah.
And that was not good for me.
Yeah.
I opened for Wet Willie and Charlie Daniels and Marshall Tucker and all these boogie bands, you know. And
it didn't work.
I got booed off the stage.
Oh, really?
At the time. Oh, fuck you, man. We want the Allman Brothers.
Yeah.
So it was one of those,
brutal.
It was tough. And I was on a gig in Vancouver, B.C. With John Hiatt. John Hiatt's agent was this guy, Mike Kappas.
Yeah.
And he had just formed an agency called Rosebud.
Right.
And so I went to get paid after my show, and there was a double contract, and I got screwed out of a lot of money. And Mike was there. He watched the whole deal go down. That was my last show for Paragon Agency.
Yeah.
And Mike said to me, listen, if you ever want to work with someone who actually likes what you do, I'm the guy.
Yeah.
And a week later, I called him up and I said, listen, I'm ready.
Yeah.
And, so I was with Mike for 36 years.
Oh, no
kidding. He booked more than 4,000 shows for me.
That's great.
And all over the world. Yeah. You know, I mean, the Rosebud Agency was just incredible.
And they're no longer?
No, he closed the agency about 3 years ago, 4 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And he had done so much. I mean, he had, you know, he did Muddy Waters and uh-huh. Willie Dixon and
oh, no
Luther
kidding.
Allison, yeah, all these yeah. incredible blues and roots players, Los Lobos, John so Hyatt, Robert Cray. I mean, Mike Kappas was the guy.
Yeah.
He was really wonderful. And just, so anyway.
He retired.
Yeah, he basically, although he's still very active and he does, you know, he's got his hands in a lot of pies.
What was your relationship with Muddy? Did you have one?
Oh, yeah. I worked a lot of gigs with Muddy. In fact, I got Muddy to sign with the Rosebud Agency.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. No, I mean, there was another just king of kings. He was... He and Wolf were, like, unbelievable.
So different, too, kind of,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, totally different. And they weren't the best of friends.
No. Well, they were fighting each
yeah,
other.
Yeah, well, they were, you know...
Competitive.
Back in the day, yeah, yeah. And, you know, the
Chicago.
Chess years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was, you know, everybody wanted to be the guy.
Yeah.
My wife, Marla, I had met Marla in 1989, and we got together in 1990. And she saw me through all of these years of sort of being rediscovered, put on the map again. And she was basically took care of a lot of the production stuff. You know, she kept track of all the things that I did well or that, you know, wasn't so perfect. Well, why don't you do that one again, John?
Yeah.
You know,
and, oh, no kidding.
Oh, she's got ears. Big time.
And when these periods, though, because, like, I mean, you've put out, like, what, 30 or 35 records?
35 albums.
35 yeah. albums. You, like, seem to do one every year or so. You tour your ass off. Yeah, I have to assume that you know, over the years, you got a good following.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's going as well as it ever did for me. I mean, maybe better, but I'm not playing as many gigs.
Sure.
I'll be 75. Yikes.
Yeah, and you put it all in.
Yeah, you know, I mean, no, I'm still having fun, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, this is still good, but it's, you know, it's something that I got to pace myself, otherwise I'm just going to melt or something.
But
I don't know. But
in the downtime, or in the time, you didn't seem to get bitter, did you?
You know, life is weird, and I knew that from the beginning. You know, when I told my father this is what I was going to do. Yeah. He said, this is a big mistake. And, you know, I mean, the business is the business, you know. It's really rough.
But I got to imagine, like, you know, having that father and then, like, knowing Bob Dylan, then knowing your dad signed Bob Dylan. There's got to be a moment where you're like, ugh.
Oh, man. Well, listen, I'm not my father.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
But at the same time, you just got to stand back and say, holy cow, what a guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he discovered Count Basie and Billie Holiday, Lester Young, Charlie Christian. He put the band together for Benny Goodman,
right, over
who married his sister.
No kidding.
He was Uncle Benny. And and then to go on from there, I mean, he discovered Aretha Franklin and George Benson.
God, he kept going.
Leonard Cohen and did the last, I mean, put Pete Seeger back on the map.
Right.
And then, you know, Dylan and...
Billie Holiday, right?
Yeah, and Billie Holiday.
And Springsteen.
Springsteen,
later.
Hello.
It's crazy.
And, oh.
Yeah.
But the business is so rough and weird. I mean, my dad had a terrible stroke, you know, and he was like... really hurting. My father never took a royalty from any of the artists he produced, ever.
Oh, no kidding.
And he took a salary from Columbia, and that was it. He never...
Really?
That was... And I mean, it wasn't even much. And so here he is sick on his, you know, in bed, and Columbia wouldn't pay for his hospital expenses.
Oh, my God.
And it took Bruce Springsteen to come and say, if you don't take care of John Hammond's medical, I'm out of here.
Wow.
And they did, and they finally did, you know, but it took that.
No kidding.
That's the business, you know. It's like, it's rough, and it's
and he weird. Tried to warn you.
He did. He said, this is a big mistake. But, you know, I mean, this was in me to do it.
Did you have any sense if he listened to your records or liked the records?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, he did?
Oh, yeah. No, he became an advocate for me, I guess, but in the background, I never asked him for anything.
Yeah, you know? But like... But he got it. He got it.
Oh, he did.
He knew you were the real deal.
Well, I don't know if he knew if I was the real deal, but he didn't want me to starve to death. No, he was an amazing human being.
And what about what's your relationship with Waits? Because that's a beautiful record you did of the Waits songs.
Tom produced that album. Yeah. I mean, with my
whose
wife,
idea
Marla.
Was that?
It was Marla's idea.
Oh yeah,
I was. Tom had asked me to do some stuff on his Mule Variations album.
You played harp, right?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
And so we're hanging out in Northern California, and my wife Marla and Tom's wife Kathleen were hanging out. And this was the studio was very near where Tom lives, the Prairie Suns studio.
Yeah.
And Marla said, listen, what do you think of the idea of Tom producing an album on John? He could be home every night, take care of the kids, you know.
Yeah.
And Kathleen said, you know, that would be a great idea. So all of a sudden we, you know, it was in our laps to do something, and out came Wicked Grin, and it was the best-selling record of any that I've ever done.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It's still selling, you know.
That's great.
I was in L.A. about 3 years ago. I was up for a Grammy.
For which record? For Rough and Tough?
Rough and Tough.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it didn't win and whatever. So, but Bug Music was having a party, and I went over there with my wife, Marla, and we're hanging out, and there's, you know, T-Bone Burnett and all these you know, guys who I'd met over the years. And there's Jeff Bridges. And Jeff Bridges walks right up to me and says, man, Wicked Grin is one of my favorite records of all time.
Yeah.
And Marla looks up at him and says, you'll always be Starman to me.
Oh.
And she nailed it. You
That's
know?
Hilarious. He's a player.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that movie was phenomenal.
Oh,
it was really good.
What was that called again? That Heart, something, Crazy Heart?
Crazy Heart, yeah.
Yeah, that was something, huh? You could see that guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know that guy. Well, do you feel like you get the respect, though? Yeah, it seems like the blues community loves you, and that you get the respect, you get the Hall of Fame.
I'm in the Blues Hall of Fame, yeah. Who knew?
And you've certainly gotten nominated for Grammys a lot. I'm sad. Yeah. I'm sorry you didn't win one.
I did win one.
For a collection?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Back in 83.
Yeah.
As the guy handed it to me, says, if the horn falls off, it can be replaced for $75.
That's what he said.
That's what he said.
As he's handing it to you? And you did the search for Robert Johnson.
Right.
Yeah.
That was intense.
Yeah.
Mississippi, Alabama.
You went down there?
Tennessee.
Yeah.
Texas.
Yeah. Yeah.
This was an English film crew that had really done their homework.
Uh-huh. And were you the host or the guide?
The host guide, yeah. On camera, no script.
Yeah.
Chris Hunt was the producer for, it was for Channel 4 in England. And Kaz Gorham was the director, and we went to all these places where they had been a year before scouted out locations and people.
Mm-hmm.
And there I was on camera with these guys, and I didn't know what to say half the time, but it came off. And
you just engaged with it?
Yeah, I got right into it, man, because I realized it wasn't going to be about selling his soul to the devil or something stupid. You know,
yeah.
It was really who he was and where he traveled. And
did you know all that stuff?
I knew bits and pieces, but I found out way more than I ever thought I'd know.
Did it move you?
Yeah, big time. There were guys that had gone to school with Robert, old girlfriends of his.
No kidding.
I mean, feeling connected like that was like really intense.
Did you ever hear those ones that they slowed down? Did you like the songs? Like somebody said that they were.
Somebody told me that. I don't believe it.
Yeah, I don't.
But whatever.
It. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, yeah. It's
you know, everybody was going to fool around with stuff that can never be really corroborated. So
sure, it's just like it is what it is, man.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Those ones. Those were the songs. The recordings that moved me,
yeah,
I mean, big time.
It's interesting to me because, like, I listen to even all the records that you do, all up to the present, up to like 2014. Is that
there's honesty to your blues that, you know, I don't hear anywhere else, and you're like one of the few guys doing it. Do you feel like it's a responsibility? You just love doing it.
I just love doing it. I feel so lucky, you know, to be still happening and rocking. And my wife Marla is like somebody that really helps make it happen. I'm a real Luddite when it comes to computers and smartphones and stuff. I'm a dummy.
Oh yeah.
And she's right on top of it and takes care of stuff that, you know, I.
Oh good.
I'm a lucky guy.
Where are you living now?
I live in Jersey City.
Okay.
We've been there for 22 years.
And what happened to your gold top?
I gave it to a guy named Jimmy Thackeray, who played with a band called the Nighthawks.
Uh-huh.
And haven't seen it since. I was told, man, that thing is worth $100,000. A 1959 gold Les Paul.
That's a reissue, new reissue from Gibson.
Those are beautiful.
Yeah, what's that other one? That other weird Gibson that you had on the cover of you're like in the grass.
Oh right,
with that corner.
It was a guitar that belonged to Felix Cavalier at Atlantic. We had one afternoon to do this photo shoot, and I didn't have my guitar with me, and. Oh, I want to use this one. And,
it's a wild-looking guitar. What was that thing?
It's a Barney Kessel model.
Okay. Yeah. Well, look, man, it was great talking to you.
Oh, Mark, what a pleasure.
All right, folks, I hope that was interesting. Go listen to some John Hammond. It'll blow you away. And don't forget, if you want a signed copy of Waiting for the Punch, go to podswag.com/punch. That's podswag.com/punch. And if you're in Seattle, come on out to Third Place Books in Seward Park on Saturday, November 11th at 7 p.m. for our final book event of the year. I can't play any guitar right now because it's too early in the morning. Boomer lives!